Hello, nice to see you again. Always happy to see your face.
Oh, thank you. Well, listen, for everyone listening and watching, I have to say this is our first Zoom video with Tracy podcast. And today my guest is a woman who you can definitely say has never let the grass grow under her feet. Strong, clever, and driven, she has lived and worked across Asia, Africa, North America, and Europe as a strategist at board level across the corporate, public, and academic sectors. She has a master's in science in population and international development, is a certified practitioner in executive coaching, and was a former CEO of Futures Group Europe, managing healthcare impact and behaviour change programmes globally. On top of that, she is co-founder of ViewPoint, a business that specialises in talent management and executive coaching. In her words, or to choose your words, Jill, convert thinking about doing into action, and is a director for SRI Executive, a global executive search and strategy consulting practice. Oh, and guess what? I've left a fair bit out.
Yeah.
Are you a superwoman? Well, she's certainly focused and definitely a woman, mother, and I'd like to add a dear friend. I'm thrilled Jill Bausch is here with me today and to give us insight into her world and how she juggles a work-life balance.
Whoa is right. When I listen to you, I think whoa is right. My goodness. Is that your first question? How do you juggle the work-life balance,
well,
Tracy?
You could say that. Yeah, I kind of thought, gosh, you've done so much. And I mean, that's all your business side and your career side.
Yeah.
And yeah, let's start with that bit. How do you juggle all that?
Well, you know what? It isn't really juggling for me because it sounds like so much, but things have naturally fallen into place in my life. And I've had a few things that were tenets for me that I stuck to. And the one of them was learning new things. And that's something that will come and go with me. And I'll think, oh, I'll wake up one day and I'll think, well, I want to learn something else. And I have insatiable curiosity, which can also be a detriment, but also I wanted to be a mom. And I remember being offered the CEO job that you referred to and saying, no, I want to pick up my kids from ballet or rugby and I had a very wonderful mentor at the time named Robert, who was the worldwide chairman of the board. And he said, if you take the job as CEO, I'll make sure you never miss a rugby game or a ballet recital for your son or daughter. And he said, you can do the work anytime, day or night. And so he was a very smart man. And so he kept his promise and I took that job. And I realized those were the important things for me to keep learning and to keep the priorities right for me. So I was lucky. Every woman doesn't have that. And so if women can seek out mentors like that and find them, then they're lucky. And I was lucky.
You're sort of driven, aren't you? I've said that you're a driven lady. And was that always intentional? You've been like that from the beginning, even as a...
No, my gosh, I was a complete juvenile delinquent when I was a teenager. You know, I was brought up in upstate New York. You can hear my Canadian, you've known me for a while, you know, my Canadian sort of accent. And I think what happened to me that I think when we look back on our lives and we think, what were the really seminal change points? And for me, I was a middle child of five and my mom had too many kids really. And so I just went my own way. And I was such a delinquent at about 15. They sent me off to a boarding school and I hated it so much that I thought, you better get yourself straightened up here, woman. And I came back age 16. I accelerated getting out of what Americans call high school. I went to university. I stopped doing things I shouldn't have been doing and started paying attention to the schoolwork, the university work. And I think at that point, I thought, yeah, it's really a bigger high for me to achieve things, do things, learn things, than it is for me to sit around drinking beer, you know, too much beer on the weekend with my, you know, my lazy mates. And I think that was a big thing that changed me age sort of, you know, 18, 19.
Yeah. Yeah. And talking about that, or going back to also, you, there's a lot of education here. you know.
You
know, the whole thing about the hygiene, tropical medicine, and your master's in population international development. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
So you, there seems to be this thread here. You know, was that planned as well, or is that just?
Yeah. You know, that's a great question. And I don't know if you know this, even though you and I have known each other for a while, but my undergraduate degree is in something completely unrelated to international development and talent management. My undergraduate degree is in fashion design.
I do. I remember you telling me that.
Yeah. And when I was growing up, my parents had two the repeated things they said all the time, two of these repeated things that really stuck with me. And one of them, my father would say often, is there are two things you can never, no one can ever take away from you. One is your education and one is the experiences you get when you travel. And so he would always encourage us to take any kind of educational opportunity we could. And often until we could fund it ourselves, always funded it. Might not fund the new pair of shoes, or might not fund the, you know, the holiday, but he would say, you want to go get a degree in something, I'm there. It always stuck with me. And I think, I hope I did bring up my children the same way. And then the travel thing too, I think, you know, when you're brought up as an American in the 60s and the 70s, you're kind of taught, well, this is the biggest and the best. Then as soon as I got to be about 18 and started traveling outside of the country, I realized I have so much I have to learn. And I was so excited learning it. And then, of course, you know, then I ended up being in love and with a British guy who I met when he was on a rugby tour of America. Mm-hmm. And then my life moved from America to Britain, and I got a great job that let me travel, made me travel internationally. And the more I did, it was like I had a fix on it. You know, I loved it. And so I was lucky to be able to do it and lucky to be able to learn from it. Yeah. It was never a strategy.
And then on that, then I'd just like to ask you a little bit about, you lived in Africa, didn't you?
I did.
Seemed to sort of live and work there, and what was that like for you?
Yeah. Okay. So you're taking, you know, middle class, you know, white girl from upstate New York, and that kind of an upbringing, and then my travels took me to different places, and so. My husband got a job. My second husband got a job, and when we both worked in a university, and we worked in development, and he got a job in West Africa in a country that a lot of people had never heard of, and I was working in development, Burkina Faso, and he worked for the Dutch government, and so he said, "What do you think? Should we go there? It's one of the poorest, if not the poorest, countries in the world."
Wow.
So we had teenage sons, and we said, yeah, let's do it. It's something we'd never done before. We wanted, even though we traveled all over, we'd been those places, living in a place like that is not the same as traveling to it. So I went from, it's strange. I mean, I went from relative, you know, middle class, somewhat, you know, well off to living in London, and living a little bit back in America at the time, just to see my mom a bit, because I'd been away a bit. And then going to live in the poorest country in the world, where outside of the gates of where we lived, which was my husband's job was with the Dutch government. Of course, we lived in complete comfort, but outside those gates, it was open sewers and very, very poor people that bled your heart every day. And having worked in development, it really became a drive for me to do what we could. I do believe that, you know, even though it's only one person at a time, that collective good that you can do is so meaningful in this world. And so that was interesting for me. It was only a year before we were transferred to a different place, but I learned a lot, and I'm really thankful that I had my sons there. Because they would come home from school every day and barefoot. And I'd say, what happened to the trainers we bought? And they said, oh, Mom, we saw somebody on the street who needed them more than I did. And when we moved out there, you know, the sons had a wardrobe full of clothes. When we came back, I think Harrison, my son, said, had a pair of jeans, a pair of shorts, and, you know, one pair of flip-flops, because he'd given it all away. And he would come home from school and say, Mom, there's all these poor kids out here. Can I bang mangoes off the tree with a stick to give them something to eat? And I'd say, of course you can. So those experiences are unlike any others. They really form you.
Yeah, that is an incredible experience, actually. And to see that firsthand and to bring it home like that, I'm actually home for a while, but to have
it really was. And what I didn't know then is these things helped inform what I love to do now. So another thing that I do now is I'm fortunate to be asked to be an advisor to MBA students at London School of Economics, where I went, and also the London Business School. And a lot of people want to work in social impact now. They want to do some good for the world at the same time as making a bit of money and having a balanced life. And so I really could speak from a personal and real perspective about what it was like to work in development. You know, a lot of words for that now, social impact or economic empowerment, but it really helped inform me to be a better coach and mentor later on, I think.
I mean, I've never experienced anything like that, but I think for me, like you, there's so much you feel like you should always be giving back. You know, there's someone who needs some help. I mean, for me, that's, you know, as you know, on the mentoring side, a lot of that with the Prince's Trust and other charities like that. But you know, there's so many people that just, you're right, even if it's one person at a time, but you can make a difference. And I think it's important we all gave back. Effect we could do, as you say, collaboratively or collectively.
But I think we all have to find the right niche for that. That for me, I feel that, and everyone will have a different viewpoint on this, the path I might take would be a different one than you or another person might take. And for me, I want it to be fulfilling and helpful, but I want it also to be fulfilling back to me. Like I'm using the skills and the knowledge that I've had. And I like to dabble in volunteering and here and there. And if it meets both terms, great. But if it doesn't, I think they could find someone else who's better at this than I am. And something else that I could do that would be more fulfilling for me.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I do agree with that. So, Jill, I'd like to get on to VivePoint now, which I believe you set up in 2000.
Yeah, I did. That's right. With a really great, a great friend and coach and mentor who I've learned a lot from, named Pippa Isbell. She was the ex-vice president of communications and public relations, public affairs for Orient Express for a long time. So she had a very deep and extensive private sector background. I had more of an international development, although in my earlier years, I was in the private sector too. And so we thought it would be a great way to team up and offer talent management. But more than that, we like to do coaching of women, really. So we've had a great time with that and tried to help women have self-confidence and find their way. And, you know, there's still a lot of, you know, the poking of that old glass ceiling still happening.
Oh, totally. Totally. And, you know, and it's that. Oh, also, I think a lot of women, it's that imposter syndrome situation as well, depending on, you know, even if they're sort of climbing the corporate ladder, they can get to positions and they feel like, should I really be here? And women I speak to who are setting up on their own business, particularly women now, I think of a certain age, I think there's women getting into their sort of late 30s, 40s, 50s and beyond even, that now. I mean, maybe their children have grown up and they want to set up on their own, but there's definitely an imposter syndrome element to quite a few of the women I speak to.
Yeah, that's an interesting point because, you know, you do, in my coaching, I hear that so much more from women than I do from men. And lucky for me, I kind of had that male mentality my whole life. I never had the, they want 10 things for a certain job and I only have 9, so I better not go for it. I always thought, I'll just learn it. And more men think that way. More women think, gee, I better tick every box before I step out of what I'm used to. And so when I do coaching, and I don't know, you're a mentor and, you know, everybody has a different style. But one thing I encourage women to do is say, go for it. You're smart. You know, you need to convince people that you will learn it. You can learn it. And most women can. They just need the self-confidence to do it.
You're absolutely right. I think it is that confidence. And also, sometimes you need someone to see it in you, you know, to see it in you and to sort of, you know, push you forward. I mean, I've been lucky enough to have people like that as well in my life. And you know, they see it and they're the ones who sort of say, no, 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 you can do it. And this is why you can do it, because you're good at this.
Yeah.
And you sometimes you just don't see it in yourself, or you don't want to see it in yourself.
No, I think that's right. Mm-hmm. You know, I love this word packaging, because I never think anybody should represent themselves in a way that is dishonest. But I think we all could do some packaging of ourselves. And that self-confidence is part of the packaging. And I've had younger women sometimes when I've done teaching or coaching and say, well, I just don't feel confident. And I said, well, then you need to fake that. You just pretend you're confident. You think of somebody who is a role model for you in your head. When you go into that interview or you go into that speaking engagement, you think of that person and how they behave. And I did that. I did that. You know, I'll tell you a really quick little story. Okay.
Yeah,
so when I was in my early career, I guess before I had children, so I was in maybe 27 or 8. And I was sent off to Amsterdam to go to a conference, and I had to speak. I was working for one of the big international hotel chains as their head of marketing for Europe, Middle East, and Africa. It was my first big talk on a podium to a lot of really senior people. And I was, yeah, as I said, 26, 27. I got on the plane and I happened to sit next to a woman a little bit older than I at that time. And she was speaking in her area. She was in the same business. And I said, aren't you nervous? And she said, why should I be nervous? I always remember I know more about my topic than anybody else in that room.
Wow.
And I always remembered that. And I think that's the case with so many people when you coach and mentor, or they know, you know more about your topic. I hope I know a lot about my topic. And if I don't, I'm going to find out, I'm going to learn it. So that's a really good lesson for me.
That is a good one. I think everyone needs to remember that story from you, Jill.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now I'd like to ask you, going again, a brief point. Now you mentioned Isabella, and she's your co-founder. And I wondered if that was a deliberate decision to take a partner on, and how does it work in terms of kind of the delegation of responsibilities and things?
Yeah, it was a deliberate decision. It wasn't a deliberate decision to think about a business and then find a partner. It was actually a decision that we jointly took, because over a period of 20 years, Pippa had worked for me. I had worked for her as a consultant in public affairs and communications. We both came out of the private sector hotel business, the big chains, working in areas of marketing. I met her when I hired her agency way back when I worked for Intercontinental. And so we had always had some sort of symbiotic relationship. And we both came to coaching kind of a little bit, you know, in mid-career, where we both discussed how we got a lot out of that, and how we talked to others, and they would say to us, wow, you know, you changed my direction in life. You gave me some inspiration or some confidence. And we thought, well, that's a wonderful thing to do. Why don't we try to do that together? So we just came to the idea of doing it. And we just put it together, viewpoint.com. And it's been a great thing. So we've worked with people all over the world now, in the private sector, in the international development arena, in the public sector, coaching, and it's been a ton of fun. Yeah, you know, I don't do many things unless it has some fun element to it. That's a prerequisite.
And on the business side, how have you found that sort of running your own business compared to, you know, being part of a, you know, corporate business? An employee, if you like.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I get asked to do from time to time, and I always try to do it, is to go to London School of Economics, where they have these panels of people that are either in the public sector and want to go private, mm-hmm. or they're in the private sector and they want to go into social impact, or, you know, doing good for others. Yeah. And people always ask, well, what's it like to shift back and forth? Because actually I've made a lifetime of going between private sector and the public sector. It's really working with the individuals. It's not really the money-making ventures versus the ones that are perhaps more charitable, which are often money-making as well. People worry about, you know, hits to their need to support families and stuff. And so there are ways to address all those things in whatever you want to do, as long as you feel that you've got some energy and some skill for doing it.
Yeah. And challenges. Okay. You must have some challenges, Jill.
Right now, my challenge is, should I turn an overhead light on? Because it looks like I'm really dark.
Oh, yeah, you could. Yeah. Oh, that, that That's good.
Okay, great. Challenges. Oh, gosh. Isn't life full of challenges for everybody?
Challenges in running your own business, you know.
Yes. Well, I think most people would say they want to do the content of the work more than they want to do the business development.
Yeah.
So if anybody wants to step out and start their own business, I would say be very realistic about the amount of time that you need to do be it business development. Because unless you have a following, I don't mean a social media following so much, but that's what everybody needs now as well.
Yeah.
But I think unless you have a following of clients, you're going to have to spend, you know, at least half your time trying to get clients.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's what I think contributes to the perhaps a lesser success to some people's businesses than others. They think, oh, I love this work, whatever the work is, you know, whatever they do. But they forget that they have to get the clients to do the work. Yeah. So I think that's probably that's been a challenge a bit. We were luckier than some because we didn't set it up until we were in our 50s. And at that point, we have, you know, you have a huge network. So we had people seeking us out. So that was great. So we haven't had to do too much of that. But I think if you're not going to do it after you have 20 years of a good network, you're going to have to do a lot of BD.
Yeah. Good point. Right. I'm going to go back to your travels now.
Okay.
You traveled so much, you must have met some incredible people and had some memorable moments. And I just wondered if there's any you could particularly share with us.
Oh, well, you're right. I have. I'll think about that one. You know, in my life where I've stood on the street corner in Tebbi in Uganda at midnight talking to sex workers and telling them, please use condoms so you keep your family safe from HIV and AIDS. And those people are incredible. They're out there working, bringing up little children, having to do something that degrades them entirely because it's the only way they can put food on the table. And to me, that is incredible.
Yeah.
And I remember going to Nepal and going into a little tiny hut where a man was selling some weavings that he had. And the hut was really about, 6 foot square. I said to him, so, you know, how do you live like this? Do you find happiness? And he said, I have everything I want. My children are here. I can sell you my tapestry and I can therefore buy them dinner. We can sleep all in one room. What else is there in this world but the closeness of my family?
Wow.
And I thought, you know, here we are in this culture admiring all these, you know, these Instagram idols, and nothing wrong with that if that's your thing. But to me, the really inspiring ones that I've met and the memorable ones, when you asked me that question, and no, I don't have your script. I don't think it was on the script. We just forgot the script and we forgot the script a long time ago. Lost the plot. Yes, I've met heads of state. Yes, you know, I looked into the eyes of Bill Clinton, and he is a charmer. yes, I've done all that. But the memorable people are really not those as much as the ones that are just saying, aren't I lucky to be in this life, even though I have so little material, so little material possessions.
Yeah.
It makes me think how, I mean, I've been lucky. I live a good life and I have some material possessions, but they're not that important to me.
No. That's really, actually, that's a lovely story. That really is. No, thank you. But and you're right. Something like that is so humbling, isn't it? You know, gosh. Yeah. Great. That's, we should all bear that in mind. We certainly should. So one of the most common comments I get, Jill, when they're running their own business, if there are times, and you touched on it when you were saying about business development and most people just want to get on with the content or producing their product or whatever.
Yeah.
The common comments I get really is that they can get very overwhelmed, like there's so much to do.
You know,
the business development, there is the marketing, there is the just basically running it, the admin. There is trying to sell it and, you know, we'll get the sales and all the rest of it and doing the doing. And I just wondered, are there times that you felt overwhelmed? And if you do, how do you manage it?
Yeah, there have been times where I felt overwhelmed, and I think anybody who tells you they don't exist would not either didn't have a good sense of what was happening or weren't completely honest with themselves. When you run your own business, sure, you have the business development, the doing the work, the financial side of things, which is exceptionally time consuming. And I've run companies now in America, here in the UK a couple of times, France. One thing is do it in a language you're familiar with, because running a business in French when you didn't speak French terribly well was not easy.
But can I just tell everybody that this lady is an amazing learner and her French is amazing. So.
It is not, and I have to disagree with Tracy here.
Oh, you're being honest.
No. So, but I think back to your point about things being overwhelming at times.
Yeah.
You know, when I went to coaching school, I took my coaching degree in about 2007 or something at the Academy of Executive Coaching in London. And they taught me many, many wonderful things and useful things. But one really useful thing was to say, okay, instead of getting a to-do list every morning, make a not to-do list. And that's really been a help, not only coaching people, but coaching myself, as we all do, because you can be overwhelmed like a tsunami of things that are on that. I really must do these things.
Yeah.
And then when you start thinking them through and you look at them, do I really have to do that today or can that go for tomorrow or next? And if you're brutal about that, which I am, what must I do today? And every day I have things in my head where I say, I will not go to sleep tonight. I will not have that glass of wine. I will, whatever, until this thing is done. And if it's, maybe it's a small thing, maybe it's just a small thing, but that tool, I guess everybody has a toolbox and that's an important tool in my toolbox, that not to do list.
I love that. Not to do list. I'm always making lists. So I'm going to take actually your advice on that, but I think what I might do is like sort of color code it. So go make my whole list and then go, actually, I don't need to do that today. And I don't need to do that today.
Right. Yeah. And then there's always the things you want to do, right? So maybe those should be on your to-do list because they're fun for you or they're interesting or they're challenging or, and then there's always those things that must be done. But a lot of things don't have to be done right now.
No, you're right. I've kind of got into a habit recently, I have my sort of to-do work list and then I have a little personal list just down on the same page in the same corner. But you're right, it's the more personal things. And I think, we are actually recording this, whenever you listen or watch this, but this is during another lockdown. So some of us have had to sort of change the way we work, definitely. And
yeah.
That little personal list of a few nice to do things is quite encouraging, really, because it just catches your eye and you think, oh yes, I must remember to do that, and that's kind of a nice personal thing to do. But I like the things that you don't have to do. That's very good.
Well, maybe you do, but maybe not right now, or maybe not today, or maybe not this minute.
Exactly. So Jill, you and I have both been mentors at some point. Do it, for either charities or individually or for our businesses. But I wondered what support or any mentoring you've had over your career, really.
Yeah, no, that's an interesting question. Sometimes when you look back, and I'm still really very busy with work, but I'm more cognizant of what support I seek and I need and I get now. Then when I look back, I think, oh gosh, I didn't know I needed that, but I got it somehow.
Yeah.
And I've had I've been lucky with some good mentors. I think everybody could stand some coaching or some mentoring. And almost every senior, now in my life, I deal mostly finding senior people in, the United Nations or various kinds of organizations like that, intergovernmental organizations. And most of the senior ones are the ones that realize the value of a coach and a mentor.
Yeah.
Because it's almost as if the more they achieve, the more they realize there's more to learn and more to know, and a mm-hmm. different perspective to take. You know, have you looked at it from that point of view?
Yeah.
To me, the definition, and I felt so strongly about this, I put the definition on the ViewPoint website, yeah. the difference between coaching and mentoring, and everybody has a different interpretation. But for me, mentoring is really going to someone that maybe has a few more stripes and, you know, than you do, a little bit more time in an area, and saying, you know, I have the situation. What would you do if you were in my shoes? And a great mentor will say, have you thought of X, Y, or Z, or look at it from this point of view or that point of view? And coaching for me is different. Coaching is not saying, how about X, Y, Z? It's more about, well, how can you think about this differently? Is there something that you can do differently? And then I had to learn, you know, I like to gab, but I had to learn to be quiet. In coaching, I had to learn to ask the right question and then wait for someone else to come to the answer, because I really do believe everybody has what they need inside. They yeah. just they have to be encouraged to find it in different
yeah.
ways.
Yeah. Oh, no, I would agree with that. But even I guess sometimes there is that crossover, because I think sometimes, you yeah. know, there probably is an element of coaching because you do want them to come to it. It's not just about telling them, you know, you want them, the light bulb to go on, and they found that moment. They, you know, they got there on their own, kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, you've been a mentor with Princess Trust for so long. In fact, you helped me get into mentoring at the Princess Trust. Mm. And I think the model that I've seen in the Princess Trust and the one the work you do and some of the work I do is kind of a hybrid of both of those things.
Right.
And you take the bits of them, depending on who you're coaching. I mean, if I'm coaching, you know, the Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, I might be doing more coaching than mentoring, because that yeah. person doesn't need me to say, how about try that? But if I'm coaching a 30-year-old MBA student from the London Business School who's got a new business and social impact in Ethiopia to empower women, maybe they need ideas. Mm. So I just customize it for the people that I talk to.
Yeah. No, very good point, actually. And I think definitely I do that. Because you can't, you know, if you just tell people, you know, they don't always get it. You know, you want to see them smile and think, oh, right, you know, like their eyes light up, like they've got their own and they see it. So they feel it then.
Yeah. And people have it inside them. They really do. It just needs some guidance to come out, I think. And you asked me about who I had in my life. I mentioned this board chair CEO of Futures Group, Robert, who completely fell in my lap, that I would have such a great mentor, a great boss. And he didn't tell me what to do. He asked me what I think I should do. And if I got it a little off, he would say, that's one way. Maybe are there other ways?
Yeah.
And he helped me be better without telling me what to do.
Yeah.
That was a very good learning experience. I worked for him for 10 years, and he was really the best mentor coach without even trying. It just came naturally to him, I think.
Yeah, I think that's been the same for me. You know, someone I work with, amazing woman, and I think she became a mentor, but just the way she was with me. And I think she just saw things and put me in situations and got me doing things which I probably didn't think I could do, and then I could do them, and that just continued. And I think it is really important to have that kind of
I think so too. I think the other thing too, I mean, everybody has a comment about their own mom, whether it's I don't really want to engage her in anything, or whether she was really meaningful to me. My mom died 3 years ago, but my mom would always say, don't give up. Just never give up. If you want something, there's no reason for you to give up. And that really resonated with me when I moved from the private sector into international development, because I applied to do that international development switch from marketing of luxury hotels to marketing of condoms and oral rehydration salts for babies not to die. It's a big shift. And I think I probably told you the story about how they turned me down straight away. You know, they said, no way, you're not what we want. You know, you market luxury hotels. You don't know anything about women's health. You don't know anything about international development. And after I had a big cry, after being told no, which I do from time to time, I thought, forget that. I'm not taking that. And I called the guy who left a message saying no, thank you on my phone machine at the time. And I miraculously got through to him. And I said, I'm not a stalker. But if you would let me come and talk to you for 15 minutes, I think you might take me into your program. And he said, oh, come on, you know, listen, you don't have any of the things we're looking for. I didn't have a British passport at the time.
Oh, listen,
but he, again, I lucked out because I guess I was persuasive enough and he was open enough. So he said, all right, I'll give you 15 minutes. But after that, don't darken my door again. And I went and met him and I talked to him for 2 hours and he had four places and he had 400 applications and he gave me a place.
Wow.
And that launched me into the whole development thing. And it's really because my mother was a coach and mentor who said, don't give up. Don't stop.
No, how great. But I think the other key thing there is he was open. At the end of the day, that guy was open. And I would say to anyone, wherever you sit in whatever industry, just be open. And
right.
Sometimes it's all you need. Give someone 5 minutes, 15 minutes, but be open.
Yeah.
Don't just close doors without that. If you think someone really wants something, you know, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I like to think of life that way, that it's a series of opportunities that we have an ability to see the right opportunity, but also to open an opportunity for another person. Yeah. And you can't always do it every day. There are times every day I have days where I couldn't do that for somebody because it wasn't possible for me to do it. But once in a while it does happen. And I try my best to see it from both sides.
No. That's I agree with you. I totally agree with you. Now, Jill, we are getting to the end of the podcast, but I've got to ask you, I can't believe you've actually got any spare time. Come on, give us a little. What do you like to do?
Oh my gosh, it's not at all scintillating. What do I like to do? Well, I'm sitting here in my dining room and I'm finishing making some linen curtains for our kitchen. We've just gotten an.
Are you still playing the cello? I'm going to let everyone into a secret. She also plays the cello.
Yeah, well, that's one of those things that I like to be better at, but it takes what I don't have, which is the time to practice every single day. I did play the cello in an orchestra for a while, and that gave me a lot of pleasure, but music is a huge part of my life right now. So in these times of lockdown, my partner and I have what we call Club COVID nights, where we get a little drink going and we turn on Spotify in every genre, very loud. And we have a little dance around our kitchen and Club COVID's what we have. That's what we're going to do.
Hey, so. I can't wait until I'm doing it with you.
Yeah, nor can I. Too long. I know it.
I have to tell everyone, we were so hoping that we would be together in the same room.
Boom.
Doing this podcast.
I know.
But Jill agreed to be my first Zoom guest, which has been brilliant.
Oh, I'm delighted to be able to see and talk to you, even if I can't be there in person. Thank you so much for inviting me.
So just two more questions. One, I just wanted to know, do you have a vision? What's going to happen for Viewpoint going forward? I mean, is there any, does it just tick along or have you got any new challenges?
It just ticks along. We don't have an exit strategy because we didn't get in it to make a certain amount of money or to be acquired. We just wanted it to be a vehicle to help people if they needed some help and sourcing, being good talent, sourcing good talent, coaching. So it just ticks along and we're happy for it to tick away. And we're really happy that if anybody's interested in taking what it has to offer, even if I say to people, go to the site, plagiarize it. If it's helpful to you, you know, just... You know, you don't have to hire us to be in it. Just if anything's helpful on it, use it.
Yeah. Okay. And so the website is, again, how can they find you?
They can find us on vivepoint.com, vivepoint.com. I lived in France when we set it up and we were looking for a name that would work in both languages. So it actually works at vivepoint or vivepoint. And it means the start of a new beginning in old Latin.
Oh, no, great. That is fantastic. So finally, Jill, I always like to ask every guest if they have one piece of advice out there that might be starting out. For you, it could, I always say starting out in business or maybe want a change of career.
Yeah, well, gosh, I never can. I always get asked one piece of advice, and I'm very bad at giving one. I guess, can I give one sentence? It might be a couple of phrases.
Yeah, it can be as short or as long as you
need. I hope it's not too repetitive, but I think that if people have confidence in themselves and they know that they have what's in them and they get the right support, mentors, advice, and they don't give up, you know, it has to go the right way. It may not go every time the right way, but it'll be going the way in a direction that's positive.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jill, for being my guest on With Tracy.
Bon plaisir. My pleasure. Thank you, Tracy. We'll do part two face to face when this all this little phase of life is over and a new one has begun.